and Authentic Business Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggles, stories, and triumphant successes of business owners across the land, coming to you in the great Peter Egan shop, which is so cool. I'm excited. We have Peter Egan, writer, author, motorcycle enthusiast extraordinaire, I think it's safe to say. So, Peter, how are you doing today?
Good, good. Holding up okay here in the... Nice to have a garage during a COVID-19 epidemic.
Yeah.
Quite place to hang out a little bit. So.
Yeah, I don't know what people do without a garage, because it's
no,
an escape.
I've got, that's why we moved to Wisconsin, but back from California, to have more garage space.
No. So. You can afford the real estate here.
Yeah, it's a little bit better. So.
But that said, I guess here with the winter, you're almost forced to go in the garage.
Yeah, it's nice. I grew up in Wisconsin and spent a lot of time working in an unheated garage, on a cold floor working on cars, and it's a real luxury to... When we built this place, I said, we're going to have a nice furnace. And
That's cool. So did you build this garage?
Yeah, when we moved here in 1990, we built it that year. We bought the house, and then it took about the summer to build the garage.
That's exactly what I did with my house. I don't care about the house.
Yeah.
I just want a garage.
Exactly.
A decent-sized garage. Yeah. So for any listeners that don't know, this is Peter Egan of Cycle World fame, the magazine, as well as Road and Track. You are an exceptional author.
Thank you.
I mean that with all sincerity, because you write about stuff that most other authors that I've read have a hard time conveying.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
I mean, nationwide trips, even international trips, road trips, not just flying, but taking motorcycles places. It's incredible.
Well, it's been nice to work for a magazine that involves travel, because what I really like to do is take motorcycle and car trips.
Yeah.
And,
so you get to write about it.
Well, I kind of worked my way into that niche in the magazine, so I think you guys need a story about somebody driving, an MGTC to Road Atlanta, or you need a story about, riding a Norton across the country.
So you would get to suggest, and then they would...
Sometimes, yeah. There are a lot of assignments in the magazine business. They'll say, we want you to go off and test such and such a car. But you can also suggest something. I have a lot of car projects, so I often would base a car project around a story idea. I think years ago I restored a 53 Cadillac.
Did you really?
Yeah, I bought it in Texas on eBay, which was a mistake. It needed a lot of work. But when it arrived, I was shocked. But I restored it, and... I wanted to do a Hank Williams trip. I like Hank Williams.
I remember that article.
So I drove this friend of mine who's a musician, Richie Mayer, went with me, and we drove down to Montgomery, Alabama to Hank Williams' home, and then drove it. It's called Hank's Last Drive because he died in the back seat of his Cadillac in 1950. Well, it was a combination of he had a lot of problems. He had drug problems. He was an alcoholic, everything going wrong at once.
Yeah.
But he died on his way to a gig in Ohio, and he followed mostly Route 11 across the South, and so we drove that Cadillac across. But the car I bought specifically to do that story, I like the car anyway. But it's a nice excuse to dabble in a car that you're interested in.
Nothing will shrink a garage like a 53 Cadillac.
Yeah, I know, it's 18 feet long.
Jeez, wow.
So
I had a 66. The 66 Caprice.
Mm-hmm.
That was a beast of a car. Beautiful car. But man, did that shrink a garage.
Yeah. Yeah, when I restored the Cadillac, there was a guy who works for the Peterson Museum out in California who called me up. He read the story and he said, that's a beautiful car. It's exactly the car that I grew up with. My parents had one, same year, identical green color, same interior.
Wow.
And he said, you will eventually look at that car one day in your garage and say, that thing's too big. And then you'll want the garage space, and I will come and buy it from you. In fact, I'll do it right now. So about a year later, I ended up selling it to him. I called him up, and he came and got it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he still got it. So
I tell you, there's just something cool about people that buy and sell and fix cars.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people, I have a lot of friends who, they buy a car and they hang on to it forever, and I admire them for their loyalty to the brand or whatever, but I'm kind of, my friend Richie Mayer, who does the same thing, calls himself the patron saint of lost causes, because he'll see some rusty old car and say, no one else will fix that thing up unless right. I buy it and do the work.
I must save it.
Yeah, I must save this car. So I've had a lot of those episodes where I spot a car and think, that poor thing is lost in somebody's backyard. I better get that out of there and fix it.
I always think of the Jay Leno. Mm-hmm. Or somebody like that who's just got hundreds of cars, maybe thousands of cars, employees to take care of those cars.
Yeah.
I feel like I couldn't appreciate all that.
Well, he's quite a good mechanic himself. I've worked with Jay Leno on a couple of stories, and I've been up to his museum several times, and he's really quite a good mechanic himself, and he doesn't just acquire things. I mean, he really knows those cars. He knows the history, and he's one of the most knowledgeable car people I've ever run into. And he loves them. I mean, he's got wonderful motorcycles and cars, and he doesn't just acquire them. He's really into the history, and he does. When I went up there to do a story with him some years ago, I walked into his shop, and he was wearing coveralls, and he was on a creeper underneath I don't think it was a Stanley. It was a steam car, a Doble. I think it was a Doble steam car, and he was changing the transmission oil.
Just look at the Haynes manual.
Yeah, yeah. Got the Haynes manual on it. It was about a 1914 Doble. I can't remember.
Yeah, before
I don't know those cars very well. Yeah,
that's crazy. But, yeah, it's interesting because when he talks to people about their car, a lot of times he seems to know more than the person that has it.
Yeah, he does. It's almost like he has to sort of fill in the blanks.
Yeah, it's just like, I'll let you take over.
But you run into that yourself sometimes when you go into a motorcycle or a car dealership and you realize you've read more about it than the person who's, some guy who's got to sell 20 different kinds of cars isn't going to pay as much attention as you do because you're focused on it. And
you did all the research.
Yeah, yeah.
And this guy's just trying to get it off his lawn.
Right, right. Yeah,
it's two different priorities.
May or may not. An enthusiast for that kind of that particular car.
Yeah, so. Hood. How do you pop the hood? I don't know. So I want to talk about your writing career. Let's downshift to when you first started, and you decided I'm going to be a writer.
Well, I kind of did it by default. I went to journalism school at the University of Wisconsin, and after about 3 years of journalism school, I decided that. I'd sort of taken most of the courses I wanted to, and I suddenly got the hot idea that I should become a doctor instead of a journalist. And
That's a 180.
Yeah, yeah. So I changed my major from journalism to pre-med, and I foolishly signed up for about 10 credits of biochem and physics. And I got about not quite 6 weeks into that second semester of my junior year and realized I was going to get about a D- average, which would keep me out of a medical school anywhere on earth. And so I dropped out, and I actually walked out of a biochem lab and walked down State Street in Madison and joined the Army.
Oh.
Yeah, and so...
another 180.
Yeah, so...
Journalism to med school to the Army.
And so I ended up in Vietnam. I went to Fort Polk as an infantry for infantry training, and they sent me to Vietnam, and I was there for 14 months, and then I got out and went back to journalism school.
All right.
And finished up in journalism. But when I got out in 1971, I graduated with a journalism degree, and it was a time when a lot of newspapers were closing all over the country. Chicago Sun had closed, and there were all these people in big cities who had a lot of experience writing for newspapers, and they were all looking for work, and a lot of them wanted to get out of the big city, and so I would go to these smaller newspapers around Wisconsin, Baraboo, or someplace like, and the editor would sort of. He would open a cabinet and say, I've got 12 applications here from people who used to work for the Chicago Sun or whatever. And he said, let me look at your resume and your qualifications. And, of course, I had about three things on my resume that I'd written for the Cardinal or something. And it looked hopeless to me.
Yeah.
So our landlord offered me a job installing rain gutters.
Okay.
So I worked for 2 years for a sheet metal company, installing rain gutters on houses in Madison. But the whole time I was doing that, I really liked cars and motorcycles, and that's what I was spending all my spare time on. Mm-hmm. And I had already started racing. Oh, nice. An Austin Healey Sprite, a Bug Eye Sprite.
Okay.
And with a little money that I had. And so I saw that I got tired of putting up rain gutters because I thought I probably wouldn't live very long.
Right.
Nearly fell off a roof a few times. And so I took a job as an apprentice mechanic at Foreign Car Specialists in Madison.
Okay.
And started out, I worked on mostly British cars, which are kind of my my weakness and soft spot, whatever.
Right.
And so I worked there for 7 years as a foreign car mechanic.
Wow.
And but I wanted to get back into journalism, and I did a lot of writing in the meantime. In my spare time, what spare time I had, I kept trying to write magazine articles and letters for the newspaper, and I wrote 2 novels that I ended up throwing away because they got rejected by everybody.
You never published them?
No.
Okay.
In retrospect, they weren't very good. Now, thinking back, I think I understand why they came back in the mail.
There's a lot of people that have been published that their books aren't that good.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, you've got to be persistent in in that business. And but eventually, I wrote a story for a motorcycle touring story about a trip that I took with Barb, my wife. And our Norton broke. I had a brand new Norton 850 Commando, and that I bought in Madison. And we decided we were going to ride out to the West Coast and go to Seattle and visit Barb's relatives in Idaho. And we made it as far as just north of Yellowstone, and it seized a valve.
Brand new.
It. And the valve hit the piston, and we were running on one cylinder, so we went laboring into Missoula, Montana.
All right.
And there were no Norton dealers anywhere in Montana.
I bet not.
I didn't have the tools to pull the cylinder head off and so on. So we ended up putting the bike on a Beacons moving van. We pushed it across town to a Beacons place, and they shipped it. We shipped it back to Madison.
Wow.
We took the rest of the trip by bus and train. And as our editor said, Alan Girdler said, came home riding on our shields, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no motorcycle. And anyway, I wrote a story about that trip. And I spent a lot of time writing it. I took almost the whole summer, and I kept writing it and rewriting it. And I thought, I'm just going to keep working on this till they just can't turn it down. I always joke. I said I worked on it till I thought even I like it, which was apparently a concept that hadn't occurred to me before. And so I sent it into Rider, which at that time was Road Rider magazine, because they published a lot of touring stories. And I waited weeks, and finally it came back, and the editor said, "Well, this is." It reads okay, but unless you had spectacular pictures, we wouldn't be interested.
Mm.
And all I had was a few snapshots. So I was very depressed by that because I'd worked on it so long, and I just threw it in a drawer. And my friend Lee Hagland said, "Well, aren't there any other motorcycle magazines?" And I said, "Well, there's Cycle World and Cycle are the two big ones." And I said, "But they publish very few touring stories. Cycle World does occasionally." And he said, "Why not send it in? You've got it. Can't hurt."
It's a stamp.
Said, "Yeah, I suppose it's a stamp." Yeah. So I sent it in, and lo and behold, Alan Girdler, who was the editor at Cycle World, liked the story, and called me up and said they were accepting it and going to print it. And he sent me a nice note and said, "If you have anything else that you want to write about, send it in. We'll take a look at it."
Nice.
So this really encouraged me, and so I did my second story, which was I bought a $100 Honda 50 step-through.
All right.
And a friend of mine who was a bicycle racer, John Oakey, and I took a trip to Pikes Peak, Iowa, and we compared the efficiency of
He was pedaling and you were on
Yeah,
scooter,
I was
right?
on the scooter.
Yes,
yeah.
I remember that. Okay.
So we compared the efficiency of a Honda 50 and a bicycle, his racing, Stella racing bicycle, and we concluded that the, I think the Honda got 168 miles per gallon, And at the end of the day, it used, whatever the gas prices were at the time, it used about 87 cents worth of gas. And John had consumed $4 worth of energy bars that I didn't bother to eat. So anyway, we had fun with the story, and they published that, and then I did three more.
Nice.
And I kept sending them in, and finally I decided it's time to hit them up for a job.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a letter to Alan and said, if they ever have an opening, I would love to work full-time at Cycle World. And I got a very nice letter back from him, but it said, damn, we just hired a new tech editor from England named John Nutting. And if we had known you were interested in working out here, we would have hired you, but you sound so happy in Madison with all your friends and your motorcycles and cars.
That's awesome.
So I said to Barb, I'm going to have to start sounding a lot less happy with my life. And but anyway, as luck would have it, Cycle World paid for John Nutting and his household to move to California from London.
Wow.
And he came to California with his fiance. And she hated California for some reason and wanted to go home. And so he was only there about a month or 2 months, and she went back to London, and she said, if you want to get married, I'll be in London. So he moved back and quit the job. And I've always thought I should send her a bouquet of roses or a thank you note or something. And because Alan then called me and asked if I wanted to work for Cycle World. And actually, at that point, I had just taken a job as a service manager at the Volkshaus in Madison. And I came home late in the evening on a very snowy night. It was cold out and raining, or cold out and snowing, and we'd had some unpleasant customers who picked up their cars, and I had a splitting headache. And I came home, and Barb said, oh, I've made your favorite dinner. And I said, I've just got to take two Excedrin and lie down. I've had a bad day. So I'm lying upstairs listening to the wind whistling through the trees outside our window, and the phone rang, and it was Alan Girdler. And he said, Peter Egan? I said, yes. He said, this is Alan Girdler. Would you like to work for Cycle World? And I said, do you read Raymond Chandler detective novels? And he says, yes, I do. And I said, that's me knocking at your door. I'll be right there. And nice. He just laughed, and he said, okay, come on out, fly out. We have to interview you. And so I flew out for an interview right before Christmas.
Wow.
And they decided to hire me. Alan said, you've been hired. We talked to the publisher and the assistant publisher and all these people. And he said, I suppose you have to fly home, don't you? And he said, we're really short-handed here. And I said, well, it's Christmas in 2 days. I said, I'd hate to stay here over Christmas and leave Barb home. And he says, okay, well, go home. And he said, turn around Christmas morning. Maybe you can hop in your car and drive out here because we'd like you to start January 2nd. So I just came home and went right back to California. And we spent 10 years out there.
Wow.
And it worked out well. I worked for 3 years at Cycle World. And one day, Cycle World was at on Monrovia Avenue, 1499 Monrovia. It was a real nice building. It was the Road and Track building.
Okay.
And Cycle World was downstairs, and Road and Track was upstairs. And both magazines were owned by CBS.
So was Road and Track, did that have a bigger distribution than Cycle World?
Yeah, yeah. Road and Track had, I think, close to 1 million readers, and Cycle World at that time was 400,000 maybe. That's about what they were, somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000.
All right.
And but one day John Dinkle, who was the editor of Road and Track, came down and offered me a job at Road and Track because he knew I had been racing. I had raced cars all through the 60s and motorcycles both, and I'd been a car mechanic, so I'd done a lot of racing with both. And he said, well, you seem to know a lot about cars. Why don't you come and work at Road and Track? So I went and talked to Alan Girdler, who had hired me. I said, I can't believe it. John Dinkle once asked me to work at Road and Track. And at the time, I didn't have any interest in working for a car magazine.
Mm-hmm.
cars, this was about 1983, and cars had really kind of sunk to a low level of performance at that time with emission controls, and they were trying to sort out their fuel injection. They weren't much fun to work on and or drive at that point, but they were starting to make a comeback. They were figuring out how to get horsepower and decent emissions.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, I went to Alan Girdler and said, I got this job offer from Road and Track, and Alan said, well, I'm leaving in a couple of months, and I don't know who the next editor is going to be, but he said, I would take it if I were you, because you can still write for Cycle World part-time, and you should be writing some car material, too, because you know cars pretty well, and you've raced them, and he said, I would definitely take the job if I were you. And I said, okay. So nice. I did. I went to work for Road and Track. But a few years later, I started writing a column for Cycle World. Alan left, and David Edwards took over as the editor, and he asked me to write I started writing a column for Road and Track first.
First, okay.
Yes. I didn't write the 3 years I was at Cycle World, I didn't write a monthly column. I was just a road test editor, and I wrote travel stories. I tested a lot of bikes, and I was also the tech editor, so if people wrote in and said, you know, I have a GS650 that's running too lean, what do I do?
Right.
You know, can I put washers under the needles in the carburetor? And so I had to, you know, call up various technical centers who worked on those engines and get all the answers to tuning problems people were having. So I did a lot of different things for Cycle World.
All right.
But...
And Barb came out to California, no problem.
Well, yeah, we had a house. We had just bought a house in Madison when I got hired. We'd had it about a year, I think. And she stayed back and sold the house. I left at Christmas Day, and she had to sell a house and got there about a month later. And we rented a house in Costa Mesa in California, Newport Beach area. And so we were there for 10 years.
And she was cool with the move?
Yeah, she was... She was kind of tired of winter, actually.
I don't blame her.
Yeah, I don't blame her either. But she was encouraging. She had been saying, why don't we just move to California? And I said, I don't really want to move out there without a job. You know, I just move out there blind and try to figure out what to do when I get there. And so when I got hired there, and we were going to move for sure, Barb was a little... perplexed. She said, oh, I can't believe we're leaving behind all of our friends in Wisconsin. All of a sudden, the reality of it kind of dawned on her, and she was a little reticent, you know, a little hesitant to move. But she was really happy out there. She's an avid gardener and raising plants and so on. So she was able to, you know, have things all year long out on the backyard.
Two seasons.
Yeah, yeah. So we had a good time out there, and enjoyed it, but gradually both of us just got tired of the traffic, mostly. It's really what drove us out. And I realized I was working for both magazines. I thought maybe we could move back to Wisconsin. My wife Barbara was a physical therapist.
Okay.
So actually she supported me in our early marriage when I was racing. I probably wouldn't have had quite enough money to race an old sports car without her help. But
that's awesome.
She had a real job. But anyway, we moved back here, and I said, I talked to both editors and said, maybe I can work out a contract where I could work from home and do what I'm doing and write for both, keep my two monthly columns going and do a feature story each month for each magazine.
So is this early 90s?
Yeah, this was 1990. We moved back here.
So this is pre-internet.
Yeah, pre-internet. It's still, the magazines were doing very well. It was a good time for the magazine industry.
That's interesting. So you essentially did what Tim Ferriss suggests in the 4-hour work week a couple decades before he wrote the book.
Yeah.
Work from home.
Awesome. Work from home.
Work wasn't forever, really.
Yeah, I did a lot of traveling. I mean, working for two magazines that do a lot of road testing, I was... I retired about 3 years ago. Four years ago, actually. But just like the traffic drove us out of California and being stuck on the interstate, I really got tired of flying, running to airports and waiting for luggage. And, you know, at the time I retired, I thought I don't really care if I ever see the inside of an airport again, because I'd be gone all the time and get stuck, you know, coming home from Europe, get stuck somewhere and, you know, in Chicago for 2 days or missing a flight. And it's kind of, it sounds glamorous, but it's fun. It's fun to do the stories, but the travel is not as much fun as it used to be.
The travel sounds amazing. Getting stuck in the airport for 2 days. No, that's cool.
So anyway, I was glad to come back here and build a garage. I wanted to have room to build a workshop.
This is very cool. This is impressive. Even just the heat that you have is...
Yeah, it's not that was a must. I said I've got to have heat in a workshop, because I'm not going to work in snowmobile boots with gloves on anymore when I'm trying to restore a car.
That's no fun.
And
I want to ask you about when you first started and you're rewriting that article. That was essentially pre-computers that didn't take up a room.
Right.
So were you typing this stuff?
Yeah, I typed everything on a... I had a manual typewriter and I had a Selectric.
Okay.
But I had a small portable typewriter that I typed on, you know, all my early stories and so on.
So when you were rewriting it, is that just...
I'd type the whole thing over again. I actually liked the process of writing on a typewriter. I was very hesitant to go over to a computer. Because I would type a whole story, finish it, and then reread it, and there were things I didn't like or things I thought I should add or leave out. And you can't do that with a typed page, and you can't send in a manuscript where you cut it up with scissors and tape it. And so I would retype the whole story, and while I was retyping the story, I would think of other things that I should add or take out.
All right.
Or a different way to phrase something. And so usually when I sent a column or a story in, I had about 10 versions of it.
Wow.
I mean, I would send in three typed pages, double spaced, and I would have 15 pages of typing for other versions of the story.
Sure.
And when the computers came in, the word processing people came in and put them in our offices, and we had to sit through a couple of days of being tutored in how to use a computer. And Tom Bryant, who was the editor at Road and Track, and I, neither one of us wanted to do that. I said, Tom Bryant, the editor, said, just leave mine out in the hallway. I work on a typewriter.
Wow.
And okay. We all had Selectrics at that point, you know, IBM Selectrics. But I still liked typing in some ways better than working on a computer. I don't do it anymore. I do everything on a word processor.
Sure.
But at the time it was, I'm not sure it really saved any time going to word processing in computers, because you know, I used to spend a lot of time retyping things, but now we spend a lot of time trying to figure out why the computer doesn't work or why the printer doesn't work or what, you know, it's you lose whole days waiting for a wise person to show up and tell you why it won't print, or, you know, a tech person.
Yeah. I used to solve those problems.
I know.
So, I remember people calling me in a crisis, and I was like, is this really a crisis? But when you get there and you see what they're doing, you're like, all right.
Well, I still like typewriters mechanically. My dad ran a small town newspaper in Elroy, Wisconsin, but he was also a typewriter repairman.
Wow.
He repaired typewriters as a sideline. So we always had old Underwood, you know, manuals and Smith Coronas and so on sitting
That's
around.
Awesome.
So.
Well, I get it. The engineering that goes into some of those typewriters is
they're beautiful,
probably more
beautiful
than
machines.
Goes into some airplane wings. It's
they're beautiful machines. Actually, there's a huge movement now for, you know, people to buy and restore old typewriters.
Okay.
Yeah, there are clubs and websites and all kinds of things for people who collect old typewriters.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome. So you come back to Madison. You're writing for both Cycle World and Road and Track.
Yes.
And then, I guess, did you publish a book at that time?
Well, the only books I've published are collections of things I've written for. I've never published a book that I sat down and said, I'm going to write a book.
Gotcha.
I would get a call from Motor Books International, and they'd say, we'd like to do a collection of your columns for the last 4 years or whatever. Would you like to do that? And so I would say, sure. And I would go through and edit it and then send them in and then read the proofs and so on.
Sure.
But
so without talking crazy specific dollars, what convinced you, I guess, let's just talk about your first article. Did they say, hey, we'll give you a couple bucks for
it? They paid me $300 for my first four or five stories that I did freelance.
That's probably not bad in the 70s.
It was not bad, but it was a losing proposition. I mean, I was doing it to try to get a resume together because I think the third or fourth story I did was I took my Honda 400F to New Orleans and went down down the Mississippi Highway, and mostly Highway 61. And I'm a big blues fan. Musically, I love Delta blues and New Orleans music and so on. So I wanted to go. I've always wanted to see. I'd read all these books about the Mississippi Delta and the great, you know, the blues men who came out of there. And
most of them, right?
Yeah, most of them. Yeah, there's one area right around Clarksdale, Mississippi, that just somewhere within about 70 miles, all of the great blues musicians, B.B. King, all these people came out of there, Muddy Waters.
Something in the water there.
yeah. Well, it was a culture there. They had big farms, big plantations, and they had juke joints. You could make money entertaining. You know, on Saturday night, there were big people who were been working hard all day in the cotton field or wherever, and they really wanted to get out and have a good time. So there are all these small clubs, and if you could play music, you know, you could make probably more money doing that than you could picking cotton or hoeing or something. So a lot of those guys who had talent saw that as a way out of farm work. But so I took my 400F down to New Orleans, and of course I didn't even have a credit card at the time. I didn't have a credit card for years, and you would take cash along on a trip. So I think I had $300.
Oh.
For the whole trip, and I had to pay for a hotel in New Orleans, and so I was in New Orleans for a couple of days after I got there, and I thought, God, I've been in this hotel for 3 days, I better count my money. And so I counted my cash out on the bed and realized if I paid my hotel bill, I was going to have about $8 left.
Oh, that's cutting it close.
To get home, yeah. And no options. And so I quickly checked out in the morning, paid my bill, and I calculated that if I could pay for my gas on the way home and stop about twice at a McDonald's. So anyway, I did that. I rode until I couldn't ride anymore, and then I'd pull off the highway with my Honda. Like in Southern Illinois, I pulled off the highway and just pulled in behind a municipal garage that had big piles of sand and salt, you know, for highway maintenance.
Yeah.
And just flopped down on the ground and covered myself with my tent because I was too tired to put it up. And then I'd get up in the morning and go again. And,
wow.
But when I got home, I had spent $300, and I'd been gone for a week and a half and written a story for 2 weeks. And I got $300.
All right,
so you know, it wasn't a money making proposition.
$300 in revenue.
Yeah.
$320 in expenses.
It looked like I was employed, but I wasn't really getting rich. But
look, Barb.
$300. But anyway, I needed to get published somewhere in order to get a resume, so I could go.
Okay.
You know, okay, here's what I can do.
All right. And, all right. That makes
that's
sense.
An important thing in writing and journalism, to show somebody something that you've done that somebody else approved of, but it's that breaking through the first time that's so hard. It's hard to get somebody's attention. And I was very fortunate that Alan Girdler, who was the editor at Cycle World, happened to like that story. You know, he read it and liked it. Another magazine editor read it and went, eh, and sent it back to me. And so there's so much timing involved. If somebody else had been there, I would have gone back to work. You know.
So what would have happened if the bike actually made it that first time?
Well, I've thought about that. I think I owe a lot to the unreliability of Norton Commandos, because if I'd bought a Honda 750, we would have made it and made it all the way home.
Yeah.
And I've often joked that, or if we'd had a BMW they were famous for reliability at the time, I don't think I could have sold a story that said a young couple makes complete trip on BMW motorcycle without a breakdown. You know,
it's so interesting. I love that story because I had a 79 Malibu wagon that broke down all the time. It's my first car. And I can attribute us being in this podcast because of that.
Uh-huh.
Because just cause and effect from me wrenching on that thing. because I didn't have a choice.
Right, right.
But it just caused you to become a mechanic, to end up in printer repair, to get a call answering service, to do business coaching, to do a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, hey, thank goodness that that was a piece of junk.
There's so much chance involved in writing and journalism and timing. The fact that I worked for Road and Track, would only have happened because Cycle World was in the same building.
Right!
You know, I never would have gone to Road and Track and applied mm-hmm. for a job. Or mm-hmm. I liked Cycle World. I didn't want to. I wasn't even thinking about changing jobs. And yeah. And nobody would have known me at Road and Track in a different building with a different company. But the fact that we're all in the same building was an opportunity that I hadn't even anticipated. And I don't know how you could do that a second time. I mean, I would never. If the timing were a little different,
right?
You know, if you get up in the morning and turn right instead of left, you lead a different life.
It's right. The whole butterfly.
Or if somebody different hires you, now you're moving there instead of here, and mm-hmm. It's always one of the mysteries of life that you know, people you meet change everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true. What have you seen change from when you first started till? I guess when you retired, I imagine things.
Well, yeah, things. The internet has been the biggest change, okay. Of course, because of when I was during the 80s and 90s working at Cycle World and Road and Track, there was really no other outlet for road testing of motorcycles and cars. And so people would wait to hear what Road and Track magazine thought of a new Camaro or whatever, or a new, Cycle World with a new Ducati. And, the magazines had a lot of clout because the manufacturers knew that. They knew that people were getting most of their information from enthusiast magazines. Mm-hmm. So they really paid attention and made sure that you got, if you wanted to test a new Honda, they had a press center in California that would make sure you got the new Honda for 2 weeks to test, and
very cool.
And also they bought advertising. I mean, Cycle World used to have, you pick up a 1980 or 70, 81 motor, Cycle World magazine, mm-hmm. and when the new Yamahas came out, there'd be a 12-page Yamaha folder, in the mag. Well, here are all of our new models.
Wow.
And Honda did this, all of the manufacturers had multi-page spreads of advertising otherwise there was no other way of publicizing what was out there.
Sure. And you're talking a handful of magazines.
Yeah, yeah. There were only about four bigger magazines that were doing that.
Right.
And so everybody knew everybody else, and everybody knew the PR people. And I should mention one of the things that comes up once in a while is that I get this once in a while in emails. People say, well, you need to watch my website because I'm unbiased. The magazines got paid off to like this bike better than another one, or if they were relying on Yamaha for advertising, that they would, of course, like the new Yamaha. And that was never the case at Cycle World or Road and Track.
Okay.
We didn't know what the ads were going to be or what the ad budget was. And mm-hmm. the editors didn't even want those people, the advertising people, to come in and tell us.
It's a separate.
Yeah, I remember one time at Cycle World, we picked the 10 best bikes, and one of our advertising guys came into our editorial meeting on a Monday morning, and he said, "I can't believe you picked the 10 best bikes, and there's no Yamaha, or whatever." I think it was it could have been Kawasaki.
Yeah.
And they just bought a 10-page ad spread. We've got to come up with one of their bikes that's in the 10 best, and Alan Gerler just about threw him out of the room. He was just furious. He said, "We don't care who advertises or how much they've spent." He said, "We're doing this for the readers. Right. Your job is to handle advertising. We work for the readers. Now get out."
Smart man.
And I went, yeah. And that was the ethic that was there when I was, and Road and Track was the same way.
That's cool.
And we had people who came to Road and Track from other magazines, and I won't say, lesser magazines, I would say,
sure.
who were very unhappy because other magazines they had worked for were influenced by advertising. We have to do a nice story on this and this because they bought a big ad,
sure.
But Road and Track and Cycle World, that was strictly, verboten. It was
That's impressive.
Yeah, it is. It was nice. It was a wonderful thing to come there and realize that you're working for honest people, straightforward people. And, and we all felt that way. I mean, that's the core of real journalism is you know, telling the truth about things. And
It's tough practice. I can imagine even with the website, if Yamaha, let's just say, came to them and said, hey, we'll pay you X amount of dollars to throw our ad up there as long as you write a good article.
No, it's still even, well, Cycle World is going online now, but Mark Hoyer, who's the editor, would no more put up with that than Alan Girdler would have.
The person that emailed you about their website, there's no difference between print or web. Advertising dollars get spent either way.
Yeah, they do. So, but I think a lot of times with online, there's so many different ads, a lot of people don't even know who's advertising and who's... Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm sure the editors know. You know who's...
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but maybe. It's a complicated world
there's
compared to...
There's a lot going
on
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, a ton going on.
So
I guess at what point did you start actually making it financially? Like, I imagine Barb eventually said...
When I got hired at Cycle World...
Okay, when it was an actual job instead of...
Yeah, it was a real job, and... you know, all of a sudden it was an actual livable income rather than just scraping by kind of thing.
And that would be a cool first check.
Yeah, it was. It was wonderful. I went out and bought a new guitar. I've been doing so ever, even now when I get do a couple of freelance stories for the magazines, if I get a nice check, maybe I need a new guitar.
Nice.
So, that is
impressive.
Where it goes.
I guess it's super cool talking to you because you're interested in cars, motorcycles, and guitars.
Yeah, too many things.
My wife told me that I had too many hobbies.
Be better if I weren't.
My wife told me that I have too many hobbies, and I'm like, I think people don't have enough.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
There's no such thing as being too smart. And you just...
No, well, I wouldn't know, but...
But, I assume from talking to people.
Yeah, I know. No, it's. I think it's fun to have hobbies, and especially now with the COVID thing going on, it's nice to be able to work on motorcycles and cars and read and play guitar. And, I think motorcycles right now are doing very well. From what I've, not all of them, but dealers I've talked to say that lower-priced motorcycles and sort of family motorcycles, like dirt bikes that kids can ride and so on, are doing very well right now because people are getting out more, and they're doing more outdoor things.
Yeah.
And the same thing is happening with canoes and kayaks. And, they're doing... And I just bought a new guitar last month from Dave's Guitar in... they've got branches in Madison and La Crosse, but they had this one up in La Crosse. And I asked them how they were doing financially right now in the middle of the COVID-19 thing, and Dave of Dave's Guitar said, he said, it's very good right now. And the salesman told me the same thing that I talked to. Nice. He said, a lot of people have decided in their spare time, they've got more time on their hands, they aren't traveling as much, they should learn how to play guitar. So he said, we're selling a lot of affordable, decent instruments, not high-end stuff necessarily, but he said even the high-end stuff is selling because people who already know how to play have got more time on their hands, and they say, well, I'm going to get something decent and get rid of this old clunker or whatever.
Sure.
So he said they're concentrating more on their hobbies.
That's cool.
So it's nice to hear some bright spots where... You know, restaurants, friends of mine who have restaurants, it's not such a happy time. And bars.
Yeah, I have friends with restaurants that aren't doing so hot. Retail, small retail, is having a bad day.
Yeah, that's the problem is there are thousands of jobs that depend on people getting out and doing things, traveling and being tourists. And it's an unhappy time for those industries.
Just moving. Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I got my Kawasaki Super Sherpa. I guess that was let's call it half a year ago. I didn't even connect it to COVID.
Yeah.
Interesting, yeah. That's true. It's fun. Do you have a favorite bike of all time?
I don't really. I've had, I'm almost afraid to admit how many motorcycles I've had over the years.
No, this is a safe place. We're cool.
Okay, I've probably had 80 motorcycles in my life, different brands. I've restored a lot of them. I've bought them, and I have friends who hang on to everything, and I like cars. My motto is life is short, and after you're dead is no time to take action.
Right. And, that's beautiful. I love it.
So, if I think a new Ducati that came out would be interesting, I will somehow scrape the money together and get that and maybe sell something else just to experience what that's like. And,
nice.
But I usually, when I buy something with a motorcycle, I've got some trip in mind. If it's a certain kind of dirt bike, I'm thinking about taking a trip with some friends in Mexico in Copper Canyon or somewhere. And
nice.
So I'll say, okay, I need a different bike. But
so I see consistency with your bikes, more or less, off-road-ish or naked.
Yeah, well, actually, when you ask what my favorite bike is, it's kind of an odd choice for a lot of people, but this Royal Enfield Himalayan is made in India. It's a 411cc bike that will go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of personality. It's kind of mellow. It works wonderfully on the back roads of Wisconsin, gravel roads, dirt roads, pavement. And it's comfortable, and I just spent a lot of time on it, especially last summer when you couldn't really... motorcycling is a great way to socially distance and not see anybody. You stop at a gas station and, fill up. And I did a lot of motorcycling this summer with friends. We'd just meet somewhere at a gas station and go for a ride and then stop at a state park or a county park.
Sure.
Sit on different park benches and eat an energy bar or something.
Right.
And you don't have to go into a restaurant or hang out with anybody, and you're out all day.
Yeah, I did that with a buddy.
In nature, having fun, so.
I did that with a buddy, and I had the FZ8, and he had the TW200.
Uh-huh.
So it was interesting, because once we get on the highway, he's like, nope. But then you tool off in the ditch, and I'm like, nope.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's you give up, when you get a smaller bike, you give up a little highway. This thing, this BMW I got last summer, is great on the highway.
Yeah,
and I don't think I would go very far off road with it. I know people do, but it's at my age and with the size of this bike, I don't really want to have to pick it up if I drop it.
No, so. I suppose this is like a long way around bike, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they did. They had an early. They had Charlie Borman and Ewan McGregor had earlier versions of this bike. They started out with the old. I think their first trip, they were probably still the oil heads.
Okay.
The earlier one. This is a water cooled one, but.
Nice.
Yeah, those guys, they did it, but you'd see them falling down over and over again in Siberia or somewhere.
Yeah.
The Road of Skulls?
Yep.
And you'd say, boy, those are big bikes to be wrestling through the bog.
They are.
And the swamps.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's something, I guess there's pro and con. You're covering some ground, but the weight of the bike.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a great road bike, and it's very fast and it handles well, but I'm starting to get happier on lightweight things that allow me to go anywhere and hit the back roads and turn around easily and get on and off.
There's something you said for that.
Yeah.
With a buddy with a KLR 650 where we went down a trail, and he said, I can't do that. And just turning it around was an event.
Yeah, it was.
Would it be easier just to finish it up than to try to turn that thing around?
Yeah, I've made those choices with bikes. When I have a large bike, I'll be riding out in the country and see a for sale sign for a farm that's up a rutted dirt road or something, and I'd see a nice house, old farmhouse at the top. Boy, I'd like to go up there and look at that place, but not on this motorcycle. I'd go back with the Himalayan and go up there in a minute, just go shooting up the hill and park it anywhere and
that's awesome.
Look around. So it's sort of a freedom machine.
Totally. That's a cool looking bike.
Yeah, I love it.
I feel like they were initially made in England or?
Yeah, the Royal Enfield was an English company.
Okay.
And I think like a lot of English companies, I think 1970 or 71 was the last year they made a Royal Enfield in England. It was right around that time. But they had a branch in India because India is a huge motorcycle market. It's probably the biggest one in the world. And so they had a Royal Enfield factory there that made essentially Indian-made Royal Enfields exactly like the ones in England. They're mostly very simple single cylinder, 350 and 500 bikes, and not particularly sophisticated, but easily worked on. So they're perfect for India. Every little town. I was in India about 15 years ago, and every town had a Royal Enfield dealership, some little hole in the wall place that had all the tires and pistons and everything you'd ever need.
The single cylinder.
Yeah. But anyway, Royal Enfield in England went broke or went out of business, but India was thriving, and so they just continued to make them in the same. They were essentially a late 50s single cylinder British motorcycle that stayed in production.
Just keep making them.
And when I was in India, almost all the bikes you saw were, there were a couple other brands or a couple of two strokes, but most of them were four stroke Royal Enfields. And now Royal Enfield in India got it came under new management.
Okay.
A big manufacturing company, built trucks and other things, bought them. And they got a new young president who decided to modernize the company and put a lot of money into it and turn the technology around. And they started a tech center in England and bought Harris Frames in England, which are famous frame builders and suspension designers.
Okay.
And incorporated that into their tech center. And so they've gone from being kind of nostalgic 50s motorcycles to being quite up to date and, fuel injected and trouble free. So
I was just going to ask you about reliability.
I've put 6,000 miles on this thing without doing anything to it, other than change the oil. And I like to adjust the valves myself and change the oil. But
okay.
It's been fine, and I've got a Royal Enfield Continental that I love here too.
That's a twin. That's a good bike.
Yeah, it's a twin. That's a really nice bike. It's a cafe racer, and which I didn't think I would ever buy again because at my age I don't really need to be leaned over the bars that much. But it's such a it's such a nice looking bike, and it's really fun to ride. I couldn't resist it.
Yeah, that's a piece of art.
Right? Yeah, it is. It's a keeper. It's a good garage bike too. I like to sit in the workshop and look at bikes.
Yeah.
I just wrote a column for Cycle World about it. My favorite thing is to sit and play guitar practice while I look at motorcycles.
That's covering it all. So, that's awesome.
I think I said in the column it's like a dual feed of Demerol coming in on two different IV hoses or something.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
That's cool. So how has the magazine business changed in the past decade?
Well, everybody has cut corners. A lot of them keep changing hands, and some companies put more money in, and others are trying to take money out, and not spend as much. And so it's very up and down. It's a much harder, it's a much harder business to anticipate now. Whether it's going to be here next year, whether it's going to be in the same form, the stability has kind of gone.
Yeah.
And I think it's a harder business to be in and to make a living in. You have to do a lot of different things.
I was thinking about that. So I just bought that Honda Blackbird. And you're doing research.
Mm-hmm.
You get on Google or whatever. And you search. And whatever website you land on, you don't care.
Yeah.
Where before, with a magazine, you would hunt down the Cycle World magazine or something like that to get your information. So now you look at the website, and if it seems like it's legit, you accept it.
Yeah.
So that name recognition is limited, which is tough. And then I think, with magazines, people are paying for a year or a couple of year subscription.
Mm-hmm.
So you almost had a contract of some kind.
Sure.
Whether they could cancel or whatever. But magazine subscriptions are $10.
Yeah.
Next to nothing. So as you had that revenue that was essentially guaranteed.
Yeah.
With a website, you're relying on ads.
Yeah, you are. And sometimes you're relying on people who are just making homemade road tests. They're trying to get a start in video and so on. Some of them are pretty good. I mean, some of them have a lot of followers. But other people, we all go online to see how you do this or that. I went online to see how to adjust the valves on that motorcycle to make sure.
YouTube University, right?
Yeah. And you know, a couple of them are excellent, and then other people just don't have a clue. It's like, oh, yeah. You know, now this is a wrench.
Yeah,
you got to put it on a bolt, and then you turn it, you know, this kind of thing. You go from mm-hmm. that guy to somebody who really knows what he's doing, who used to work at the factory. So right. You got to be careful online.
There's no finer option on YouTube than that 2X speed thing.
Yeah.
Speed up through this babbling.
Yeah, I know it.
That's fair. So, I imagine people are doing that with this too. That's all.
Yeah. Don't fast forward.
Whoa. But it's just an interesting. Even with newspapers,
mm-hmm.
I just interviewed a woman that's running the Edgerton newspaper.
Yeah,
and it's tough. What a tough
business. Sure it is. Sure it is. Yeah, yeah. We subscribe to the Wisconsin State Journal, and I've just got to have a real newspaper in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that this morning. Thought, what would I do if I couldn't get up and go get the paper and drink coffee while I look through the paper and then do? I like to do the crossword puzzle usually, and
all right.
And I think I wouldn't want to sit here and do this online. I think maybe I've worked too much at a word processor, but I have no desire in the morning to sit with a cup of coffee at a desk and look at a screen.
Have a light shining on.
Yeah, I want to sit back and, mm-hmm. in a comfortable chair and drink coffee and look and page through it and then go back and read something and look at it again. And I feel the same way about books in print.
I'm exactly the same way.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do. I think, e-books and so on just don't work for me. I like to flip forward and look at something and look at the pictures and mm-hmm. then reread something and... I like to handle a real book,
yeah.
And so I don't have any interest in mm-hmm. reading a book online at all.
I got to compliment you on your last book, because I saw an article on you, and I'm like, this sounds like a cool book. I pick it up, or I bought it, whatever, and when it showed up, it's almost like a coffee table book. It's not huge, mm-hmm. but the way that it's labeled out with the color.
Oh, yeah, they did a nice design job.
Incredible job.
Yeah. That's Zach Miller at Motor Books is a very good editor. He's a friend of mine, and he did a beautiful job on that book.
It was interesting, because I read three articles in there, and I immediately bought another one for my buddy.
Oh, good. Yeah, we like to see that happen.
I don't even know if he read books, but he's a motorcycle guy, and I was like, this is cool to look at.
Yeah, they did a nice job. They did a nice cover design, and I love the artwork in it. I thought it was... when they suggested doing that, I said, "Well, I hope they get the right mood." And he really did. I mean, some of the pictures in there, I thought that's exactly the picture that should be with that.
Yeah.
You know, the state of mind of that story. And
it's an impressive book.
Yeah, I like it a lot. That's a real keeper for me. So,
how many books have you pushed out that were?
Well, they started when I was at Road and Track in the mid-80s, Brooklyn's Books in England used to print soft cover collections of things from magazines. Like they would have a Brooklyn's book, Road and Track on MG. They would reprint all of the stories that Road and Track had done on MG road tests and trips and so on. And so they would put out collections of columns too. We used to have a really... popular and excellent columnist named Henry Manny III.
Okay.
Back in the 60s, he had a big following, and they put out a collection of Henry's columns, which I have. And Henry was a good... I was lucky enough to meet him. He was still working when I went to work at Road and Track, and a wonderful guy.
Okay.
But so they would put out those collections, and so the first things they did for Road and Track were they said, how would you like to put out a collection of your columns from Road and Track? And I said, sure, that's fine. So the first three or four books I did were Brooklyn's soft cover books. They were in hardcover.
All right.
And then the people at Motor Books International, which is up in Stillwater, Minnesota, or they were, but they decided they could put out a hardcover. They did one of road stories that I did, and I think there are three different hardcover collections of columns.
Okay.
And the book you're talking about is a best of collection,
yeah.
which I describe as the least objectionable of. But anyway. we they put that out, and it included some new stuff that had never been published before in a book,
right.
And then some of the ones that did well, mm-hmm. from the old magazines.
It was neat how it was laid out chronologically.
Yeah, I thought that was a good idea. They wanted to go by decades, and they had sort of a representative motorcycle for each mm-hmm. decade, and mm-hmm. included a picture of that. It was a good way to divide it up.
Yeah,
in different color.
I'm reading a book on Harley Earl,
uh-huh.
the GM designer.
Yeah, sure.
Great design. And it's interesting how that, I guess it reminds me of your book, how there's stuff going on historically outside of motorcycles and cars,
mm-hmm.
but still kind of interferes or influences that industry.
Yeah.
In your articles, you could see little things that influence that.
Yeah, it's 40 years of that's a lot of history in motorcycle. A lot of stuff changes over the years. So
yeah, that's super cool.
Goes way back.
So if you were to give a piece of advice to someone that was considering writing a book or becoming an author, article writer, whatever, I guess, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well, I don't know the ins and outs of and the finances involved in doing work on the internet, on websites and so on. I shouldn't be giving any advice because I'm kind of out of that picture. But I would say persistence is the thing. I mean, no matter what it is you're doing, you got to keep at it. I think it was, I can't remember who it was, probably Hemingway said a writer is a person who writes.
I love it.
Yeah. And you don't talk about writing. You write stuff and then you send it in.
That is it's interesting. I presented at this When Words Collide thing in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
Because when there's COVID, stuff like that isn't in person. So it's remote, and lo and behold, I'm remote. Or was able to be. And I'm talking to these people that are would-be authors.
Mm-hmm.
And you're asking them, what did you write the past 6 months? I put down 1,000 words or whatever. You're trying to write a novel, an 80,000 word novel. In the past 6 months, you laid down 1,000 words, unedited.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, there's a problem.
Yeah.
You don't have anything to. There's no product.
Well, it's hard to motivate yourself to mm-hmm. to write if you don't have, if you don't think you're going to be able to sell it or have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Another great writing quote, I can't remember, I think it was a French author said, or maybe somebody from England, I can't remember who it was, but he said, only a fool writes for free, without hope of making money doing it, because otherwise, what's the point? Because if people won't pay for it, maybe it's not good enough.
Oh,
and,
it's not worth it.
Yeah, so I mean, that was what was implied, but...
Sure.
There's a certain amount of truth to that, but I think it's hard to motivate yourself to write. It's a lot easier for me, after all these years, to have an assignment or mm-hmm. to have Cycle World or Road and Track say, we need your column by next Tuesday, and you stare into space and you think, oh my God, I have to have a column. What am I going to... And then you say, oh, I just changed the tires on this motorcycle.
Sure.
But otherwise, if you don't have that deadline...
Mm-hmm.
There's not much need. It's a lot of...
I'm trying to think where we were before the camera died.
Talking about making a living as a journalist.
Yeah. The advice was persistence.
Yeah, I think you just have to stay at it no matter what.
But, yeah.
But it's hard to give direction right now for a career in journalism.
Right.
Because... obviously, people still go into broadcast journalism quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where, I'm not sure with magazines and online publications.
I see so many people, some talented, some not so much.
Mm-hmm.
They get on YouTube and things like that, and they essentially become famous.
Well, there's more opportunity, I think, now with the internet, because you can get...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people have done YouTube things on motorcycling, and if they're mm-hmm. good, they become really popular, and the whole world is watching.
Yeah.
And they just did it themselves, and they didn't have to go through the hierarchy of
the
magazine editor who likes them enough to hire them and mm-hmm. reads their stuff, and they can, if you're real self-driven.
Yeah, the barrier to entry is much lower, I think.
Yeah.
But then that also brings in a lot of competition and lesser less than great.
Yeah, but I think some of that melts away. And mm-hmm. I mean, I watch several people who do travel things on motorcycles now. Mm-hmm. You've got this young woman from Holland who does a program called Itchy Boots. She bought a Royal Enfield Himalayan in India.
Okay.
And rode it across Asia. And did the whole thing herself, just traveled
alone
and did it with a cell phone, really, and a handheld camera. And half the people I know who ride motorcycles have watched that program.
Really?
She was on her way up from Tierra del Fuego to Alaska. I think she was in northern Chile when the COVID virus hit, and she couldn't travel anymore, and she had to go home and abandon her motorcycle. But she had a huge following. Probably just did the whole thing herself from the start.
That's pretty cool.
And there are a couple of very good young guys who are testing motorcycles too, and they're mm-hmm. very funny and informative and know their stuff. And
some of the videos that I see, the editing mm-hmm. that they do,
yeah,
like that alone is impressive.
But they're, you know, they are able to do that without mm-hmm. having to go through sort of the pyramid of journalism and you know, working their way up to getting to this magazine or that magazine mm-hmm. and without the travel. And so
that's fair. It's interesting. Maybe
there's a little more democracy in it. I don't know. There's a lot of bad stuff, but there's a lot of good stuff on the internet too.
Yeah, imagine before you're relying on a dozen people in a given industry with their magazines mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff, and now it's like you got a camera and some time.
Yeah, when I worked for Road and Track, I mean, it was essentially Road and Track, Motor Trend, Automobile, Car and Driver,
mm-hmm.
and who were doing international, you know, Hot Rod was doing mostly American stuff, but mm-hmm. If you went to a press introduction, you saw the same, we all knew each other. There's a total of about 35 people
sure.
at any given time in America who are going to be
awesome.
Writing stories for those magazines.
All right.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not very many people who like to write about cars. And, of course, you have other club magazines and so on, a lot of good writers in them too. But I think it's, in some ways, it's easier to be seen or heard now than it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
availability is there.
But you've got to be very motivated, too. You have to figure out, you know, what it is you're doing and do a good job.
Right, because there's a lot of people trying to be seen and heard.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, Peter, thank you so much. This has been cool.
Yeah, great to talk to you. And
This is weird, because I'm in Peter Egan's shop here, which is...
Oh, what a deal. Yeah, pictures all over, clutter, everything.
No, compared to my garage, this is all right. But I
cleaned up a little bit when I heard you were coming. I said, I can't leave that on the middle of the floor. I'll push that over there.
Well, awesome. This has been Authentic Business Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggle stories and triumphant successes. Here with Peter Egan. Peter, thank you so much for being on the show.
Great to be here. Enjoyed talking to you.
This is awesome. I should have brought a bigger battery.
Yeah.
Hey, wasn't that awesome? Peter Egan, episode 150 on Authentic Business Adventures. Authentic Business Adventures is brought to you by Calls on Call, offering call answering services for small businesses across the country on the web at callsoncall.com, as well as Draw In Customers Business Coaching, offering business coaching services for businesses looking for growth on the web at drawincustomers.com. And of course, the Bold Business Book, a book for the entrepreneur in all of us, available wherever fine books are sold. We'd like to thank you, our wonderful listeners, as well as our guest, Peter Egan, on episode 150 of Authentic Business Adventures. And you know what to do, man. If you do nothing else, enjoy your business.